Hello and welcome to another episode of the 94 Feet Report NBA podcast. I am your host, as always, Eric Spiropoulos. You can follow me on Twitter at Eric Spiros. You can follow our website on Twitter at the 94 Feet Report. We launched our website on July 1st. You can find it at 94feetreport.com. We've got a lot of free agency reaction and great articles. We're currently running a team offseason review series. So it's hashtag 30 teams, 30 days. So each day a new team's offseason review article is posted. So check out our website for that. We got a great team. We're actually expanding. If you want to apply to join our website, you can do so by emailing the 94 Feet Report at gmail.com, or you can just find it on our Twitter or my personal Twitter. Today's episode of the podcast will be a kind of off-season review. We'll touch mainly on free agency, and we'll also touch a little bit on summer league. We'll be joined by Alex West, the host of the And One podcast, which is also affiliated with the 94 Feet Report. We've had him on the show before for one of our Fresh 15 free agency recap podcast episodes, so it's always great to have Alex on. Really great guests. We talk mainly about free agency, the big signings, the trades, winners and losers, touch a little bit upon summer league. So stay tuned for that conversation with Alex, and then follow us on Twitter at the 94 Feet Report. You can follow me on Twitter at Eric Spiros. We are now joined by Alex West, host of the And One podcast, which is also affiliated on the 94 Feet Report. Alex, how are you doing today?
Good, Eric. How are you?
Doing pretty well. It's been quite a while since our last episode of the 94 Feet Report NBA podcast. We've got a lot to talk about, considering the fact that I decided to do an entire off-season review podcast, which includes a lot of things, because this is one hell of a crazy off-season.
This is the craziest off-season I can remember, most definitely.
And especially because the first thing that we're going to talk about are the trades that happen. And these trades, two of them actually happened before free agency technically started. One happened basically midnight July 1st. But there are three huge trades that basically all went to the Western Conference, so they made the Western Conference a bloodbath. But it really all did change a lot in the NBA landscape. Let's start off with, I think, one of the most interesting trades and probably one of the best trades in terms of, you know, the fairness of the trade itself. CP3 is now a Houston Rocket, which still sounds very weird to say. You know, my initial thoughts on this trade are, you know, as I mentioned, it's probably the fairest trade of the three by far, because the Clips actually got a pretty good return for a guy who was going to leave anyways. And it's nice of Chris Paul to kind of decide that he wants to go to the Rockets. He tells them and they can get a trade done, because the Clippers did get Patrick Beverley, Lou Williams, Sam Decker, and Montrezl Harrell. They also got a first round pick, but they ultimately traded that away in the sign and trade for Danilo Gallinari. But those are four, you know, in my opinion, four rotational pieces. It makes the Clippers a lot deeper. You know, their bench has been something that's killed them over the past couple of years, basically for the entire CP3 run. And then obviously the Rockets get CP3. So, you know, when you look at the other trades, this one looks like a very fair deal overall. And I think it really kind of puts together one of the most interesting superstar pairings I can remember in recent history in James Harden and Chris Paul. So what are your thoughts on the trade and how this moves forward for both teams?
I know that Daryl Morey doesn't need my affirmation with this trade, but that's one of the things that I was really impressed with, the nuts and bolts of this trade. To be able to do it with non-guaranteed contracts, to be able to pull together pieces that weren't necessarily on the roster, and to be able to put together such a quality trade package to land Chris Paul in a very short time and sort of up against it with free agency coming up was a very impressive thing to do. So the nuts and bolts of it are pretty impressive to me, but the basketball fit, jury's still a little bit out on it. You never turn down wanting quality players, particularly guys who can handle the ball and can get buckets late in games. You never want to turn that down, but the switch over from James Harden playing the two guard primarily 2 years ago to playing the one last year was wildly successful under Mike D'Antoni. And so to bring Chris Paul in, and, you know, I always say that you always trade four quarters for a dollar, or in this instance, you always trade three quarters for a dollar. But to bring in a player who plays essentially the best or the same position as your best player is sort of strange to me. And so I think there's going to be a lot of a learning curve for D'Antoni, for Chris Paul, for James Harden. But, you know, this is something you always do. You always pull the trigger on a deal like this.
Yeah, and the important thing about this, probably the most important thing with this trade, and potentially, you know, a trade for Carmelo Anthony, which seems to have which seems the most likely to happen before the season starts, but that's something we can't really talk about yet. But the most important thing in situations and pairings like this is the two players specifically buying in to changing their roles in hopes of winning. And Chris Paul, almost immediately after the trade happened, I think it was Mark Spears who reported that Chris Paul's, you know, one of the reasons he decided to join Harden was because he was actually intrigued by playing more off ball. And Harden, you know, in recent interviews and press conferences has said that, you know, it would be nice to just run the floor and get some open catch and shoot looks. Well, it's nice to talk that game, but, you know, how many times have we seen players say, oh, you know, I'm gonna be so willing to change my game, and then they don't like it initially, and then it all falls apart. And, you know, this better work out for the Rockets, because Chris Paul can be and will be a free agent next year if he doesn't sign an extension. And if things don't work out, he's going to leave, and then the Rockets lost all this depth for basically nothing. So, you know, the most important thing is that those both players buy in. And if they do buy in, I mean, I think that, you know, with Mike D'Antoni as head coach, the combination and the possibilities are endless offensively, because they've, you know, for now they still got elite shooters in Eric Gordon, Ryan Anderson there, Trevor Ariza still there, Clint Capella, I think, is the perfect center for this Rockets team. So obviously both players have to buy in, and if this is going to work, and obviously, as you said, it kind of the jury's still out on if they will do that, and especially if they were to add, you know, a guy like Carmelo Anthony, that changes things even more drastically.
Houston's one of those teams that they're very willing to. Daryl Morey has displayed it many times over the years that they're very willing to go all in on a hand, and that's what they did here. They went all in on a hand, and yeah, there's a little bit of an emergency parachute built in that. If it doesn't go well by the trade deadline, they can turn around and deal Paul and get back probably some quality assets. Even though he is a free agent, there's still something to be regained. But they've sort of put a lot of their chips on the table here. And adding Carmelo Anthony's just essentially doubling down on that. Is you sacrifice depth, you sacrifice youth to put together a team full of you know, these high-quality players in Chris Paul, James Harden, and Carmelo Anthony. And I think that's what they've done here. And I think that that's something that they've systematically shown that they'll do any time because of the valuation of superstars are a commodity in this league, and gaining that kind of commodity is not something you can do all the time. So Daryl Morey does it whenever he can.
Yeah, and that's the thing you have to appreciate with Morey. He is never willing to just, you know, take a step back. He's pretty much the opposite of Danny Ainge. Like, when he has assets, he uses them almost all the time. He doesn't just, you know, hoard them in hopes of, you know, trying to swing a deal. He always goes after it, and, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. And that's probably the most interesting thing, and that's what makes the Rockets one of the most interesting teams in the NBA every year. There's never really a dull year, or there's never a dull offseason or trade deadline for the Houston Rockets and their fans. But the Rockets did also make other moves, which we'll get to later in this episode. We want to focus on the big trades first. But the Rockets did end up, you know, I think, rebuilding their bench in a very good way, especially in a better way probably than last year. But we'll get to that a little bit later. And we'll turn to our second big trade that happened. This one happened basically right as free agency was starting. No one expected this to get this Woj bomb. You know, people were expecting signings, but they weren't expecting this trade. Paul George is now in Oklahoma City. And Oklahoma City, in my opinion, just fleeced the Pacers. They got him for Victor Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis. And, you know, I just can't believe that this was the trade that the Pacers ultimately accepted. Obviously, there were rumors after the trade happened that they had a three-team deal with the Cavs and Nuggets. And the Cavs, I think a couple days ago, it was rumored that the Cavs were so close to acquiring George. And ultimately, this is the deal that gets Paul George to Oklahoma City. And I really like this trade. Obviously, of course, if you can get a top player. Now, people's opinions on Paul George are varying. Some people think he's a superstar. Some people think he's just a star. Some people think he's overrated. Some people think he's underrated. But I think he's just the ideal fit for, you know, I guess I would put a star. The ideal star to fit next to Westbrook. And I think that alongside Westbrook, he can have somewhat of a decreased offensive role in terms of ball handling and creating for others, which could allow him to save some energy to return to that elite defensive level we saw the past couple of seasons. You know, his defense has fallen a little bit, but he's had such a big offensive role in Indiana that maybe he can return to that level. And I think he's such a good off-ball fit that it won't force Westbrook to change his game that much. Obviously, Westbrook will have to change and adapt, and both of them could be free agents next year. So if it doesn't work out, kind of like the Houston thing, they could both leave, or George could leave. So that also kind of puts some pressure on OKC. But, you know, what are your thoughts on Paul George to OKC?
this is one of the more compelling storylines for me, because George presents such an interesting fit. He's a guy who can guard multiple positions. He's a guy who can create his own shot. And he's a guy who got probably, quote-unquote, overused in Indiana because they needed that kind of production for him. So it'll be interesting to see him slide into a secondary role in Oklahoma City. And I think it's something that he's well-suited for. He's not a tremendous catch-and-shoot player, but he can certainly do that. And he's definitely a quality rim runner. So that's probably the most interesting basketball fit for me. The other thing about this trade that I really enjoy is for the Thunder is getting rid of Victor Oladipo, who was on a big contract, and getting rid of Domantas Sabonis. This was essentially a glorified cash dump for them. Mm-hmm. They needed to get rid of some contracts. They needed to get rid of some longer-term deals. And what they did was they turned Victor Oladipo and Sabonis into an expiring deal. And that expiring deal happens to be attached to an all-star. But it frees them up to move forward with more flexibility than what they had. And Sam Presti probably learned his lesson. I mean, we all well know it's well-documented, and there's been a great wailing and gnashing of teeth about the Harden trade and how that sort of was the undoing of the Oklahoma City dynasty that never was. But I think that kind of flexibility is showing that Sam Presti has learned from what happened there, because now he can make a run at Paul George. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But then he turns around and he has a lot of cap space to chase another star or to put a big offer sheet in front of Russell Westbrook. So there's flexibility. Even if they end up losing both guys, they're not going to be in a terrible position going forward in terms of what their cap is.
Yeah, and that's probably one of my favorite parts about this trade, is that the Thunder, in this trade alone, actually saved money and got, obviously, the better player. Just a fascinating situation now for OKC. I mean, if it works, then maybe both could re-sign and they could have some success. I don't think they're going to challenge the Warriors, but they could make the conference finals theoretically. And we'll talk about later on in the podcast their other moves that they made that I really liked. But if it works, both could sign and stay, and they could have a nice duo for the next couple of years. If it doesn't work, both could leave. George seems more likely to leave with all those rumors about LA, but he could certainly. He does have a year basically to recruit Westbrook if it doesn't work. So both could leave, and they have a lot of cap space. Maybe Westbrook stays and George leaves, and they still have some financial flexibility. So, you know, in terms of basketball fit, I love it. In terms of future finances, I love it. Even finances for this year, they were able to use to get some other role players that we'll talk about in a little bit. But another great trade. And the third trade we're talking about, again, another Western Conference team getting stacked and joining the quote-unquote arms race to challenge the Warriors. Jimmy Butler to the Timberwolves. I think this is another fleecing, kind of like the Paul George one. Ultimately, the Wolves sent Zach LaVine, Chris Dunn, and the 7th pick to the Bulls. They got Jimmy Butler, and they somehow managed to also get the 16th pick, which I still find, you know, incredible how the Bulls were still trading that, even though they were still getting fleeced originally. I think it's going to be interesting to see how Jimmy Butler and Andrew Wiggins mesh, especially with, you know, the other offseason moves and signings that they have limited shooting in the Timberwolves, you know, starting lineup and the team pretty much overall. And obviously in today's NBA, shooting can really stagnate or handicap an offense. So I'm interested to see how that meshes. And, you know, we can talk about this trade in addition to the other signings that they made, because they did. This trade was not the only move that the Wolves made this year, and they're really hoping to make a huge jump in the Western Conference. I think they won 31 games last year, so they've got, you know, a ways to go, but they made so many moves that they could, you know, people are definitely expecting them to make the playoffs. So what were your thoughts on this trade in terms of the Wolves getting Jimmy Butler?
You hit the nail on the head with this one. This is such a mixed bag for me, because on the one hand, you know, going after trading Zach LaVine and Chris Dunn and Lauri Markkanen and turning it into Jimmy Butler is fantastic. That's what you do all the time. Yeah. However, it puts you in a position where you're probably your best three-point shooter is Karl Anthony Towns. And if anything, the league has shown that having the flexibility to have big men shoot or having several shooters on the floor is probably the way that you want to play the game. In fact, so much so that you don't see a lot of lineups where there's more than one guy who's not a proficient three-point shooter, you know, because defenses can sag off of him and start to create problems. The Celtics went through this with when they played Marcus Smart and Jay Crowder at the same time, and both of those guys are pretty good shooters, but it allowed LeBron to guard Marcus Smart in the Eastern Conference Finals and sort of sag off of him, which created a lot of problems. And so I kind of think that's what's going on here. When you have a lineup of Jeff Teague, Andrew Wiggins, Karl-Anthony Towns, Jimmy Butler, you don't have as much spacing as you'd like to maximize what those guys can do. Now, on the other side of it, I think it's a god-awful trade for the Bulls. Mm-hmm. Throwing in 16, it just blew me away. Because, and we'll talk about the Bulls, but there's just so many things about this. Not taking Dennis Smith, not hanging on to 16, selling 38. The Bulls offseason has just been a disaster. And so I think nobody's happier about getting out of there than Jimmy Butler is.
Yeah, and the thing with the Bulls, and the thing with any of these trades, especially talking about both Paul George and Jimmy Butler trades, is you have to kind of, if you put yourself in the shoes of those teams' front office, the Pacers' front office and the Bulls' front office, those are teams and front offices that, overvalued players, according to the rest of the, NBA fans. Like, I'm sure the Pacers overvalued Oladipo and Sabonis. The Bulls, we know, have been in love with Chris Dunn, and he was bad in his first year, and people don't really see him getting a lot better because he's already, I think, 23. So in that perspective, you can almost see why the Bulls think they got a decent deal by saying, "Oh, we got our man Chris Dunn finally," or the Pacers saying, "Oh, we got Oladipo from Indiana and Sabonis, who has great potential." But meanwhile, almost the majority of other fans, front offices, and analysts think that they're crazy for valuing those players. So that's why some of these teams, like, we laugh at them getting fleeced, but, probably their front offices are thinking that they got a pretty decent deal. I mean, considering how they overvalue these kind of young players.
I sort of put these in two different boats. Chicago, I feel like there's a lot going on, and the fans will sort of back this up. Did you see that they bought a billboard that said "Fire Garpax" in Chicago this week?
Yeah.
So I kind of think that's what's going on with Chicago, is there's a little bit of incompetency running the organization. In Indiana, I think it's a little bit different because I don't think that Kevin Pritchard and the Pacers wanted to deal in the Eastern Conference. Mm-hmm. And they also didn't want him to end up on the Lakers. So that sort of shot down two of their biggest deals, because that Boston could have trumped that trade package. That LA could have trumped that trade package. But I feel like there was a little bit of spite. They didn't want to have to face Paul George three or four times in the regular season. And then also they didn't want him to end up where he said he wanted to be. So I feel like that's what happened with that Indiana trade.
Yeah, I guess I could totally see that too. But, in the end, if you're going to be a good front office and you're going to set your team up for future success, you've got to take the best package. Obviously the Celtics could have beaten that package, and we still don't know exactly what they offered. There were a lot of rumors that they offered a really big deal at the trade deadline, and then they kind of took some of those assets away in a potential trade offer during the offseason. But in the end, if the Celtics gave you a better package, I know you don't want to face them three to four times a year, but you're going to be bad anyways, and you might as well get more assets for the future. I get why they probably were thinking that way, but in my opinion, I would not think that way if I had a star and I was going to trade him away.
Oh, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. You want to get the best possible pieces, and adding some combination of Jay Crowder on a reasonable contract, Marcus Smart, maybe the third pick, which probably still ends up being Jason Tatum. There's a lot more pieces available, but I definitely see by the same token that nobody wants to be the one who gets fleeced by Danny Ainge again. And so there's a lot of, for the Celtics, it's sort of fraught with peril anytime they deal for a superstar or deal with other teams in general, because Danny Ainge has built such a reputation as a high quality trader.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of Danny Ainge, let's move on to free agency signings. So we're past our major trades segment, and we had a couple of big free agency signings in terms of teams joining new teams. Let's start with Danny Ainge and the Celtics. They were able to sign Gordon Hayward, and I always thought that it was going to come down to the Celtics and the Jazz. I didn't really ever think that Miami was going to be a real player for Hayward, and I always leaned Boston just because I could totally see him there with, of course, Brad Stevens there, that kind of Butler connection. So I almost saw this coming. Now, the way it happened was ugly and messy on July 4th and really annoying for a lot of fans and really kind of emotionally killing for Jazz fans. But in the end, Gordon Hayward is now a Celtic. Like, the Celtics did have to lose Avery Bradley and Kelly Olynyk, in order to create space for Hayward, but they were still able to get Marcus Morris for Avery Bradley in that very interesting trade with the Pistons that we can talk about a little bit. So I guess my question is, your thoughts on the signing and the moves that had to be made afterwards in order to sign Hayward, and then kind of how much closer do you think this puts them with the Cavs?
So the acquiring Gordon Hayward is a very good move. You sign an all-star, you do lose Avery Bradley, who's essentially probably your third best player, and you lose Kelly Olynyk, who was sort of, his value is sort of overinflated. As somebody who watched a lot of Celtics games last year, Olynyk was not a great rebounder. He was a guy who was streaky. He could score sometimes, but I don't really feel bad as a Celtics fan letting Olynyk walk. It does feel sort of hurtful to let Avery Bradley walk, just because he was the last player who played with the big three. a lot of Celtic tradition there. But from a basketball point of view, adding Gordon Hayward is such a huge boon for the Celtics, because he allows them to do something they couldn't do last year, which is run offenses without Isaiah Thomas. Mm-hmm. The Celtics had so much trouble moving the ball and finding open shooters and just having offensive flow when Isaiah Thomas wasn't on the floor. And adding Gordon Hayward as somebody who can be your primary creator allows them to do that. So you have, essentially, you've added a second scorer and you've added a second ball handler. So to me, this is a home run deal. Losing Bradley hurts on the defensive end. They also have Marcus Smart. And Marcus Smart can do something that Avery Bradley can't do, in that he can guard bigger forwards. Bradley was sort of limited defensively. He was very good at guarding ones and twos and threes, but then when he could stretch into the fours, that's when he started to get overpowered. And Marcus Smart can do that, and he's on a much more reasonable contract, and he's probably not going to command the market value that Bradley's going to command. So I think all around, like, this is something you do 10 times out of 10 to get this kind of player. And I think the Celtics are probably a little bit better suited to battle the Cavaliers. Now, I'm not willing to say that they're over the hump, but I definitely see this being a 56-57 win team in a weakened Eastern Conference and probably another Eastern Conference Finals run.
Yeah, I can totally see it. Right now, I mean, things could change, but right now I think if they were to play like the same Eastern Conference Finals series against the Cavs, I could see it going maybe like 6 games, maybe 7, depending on some, you know, weird circumstances. But you did point out some interesting things. You know, for the Celtics, this team had a lot of interesting contract situations. So Avery Bradley will be unrestricted next year, and Marcus Smart will be restricted. So that's why the Celtics, you know, they can somewhat control the Marcus Smart free agency. They can kind of scare teams off from offering him a sheet, but they could not do anything to control Avery Bradley's free agency. And they still got Isaiah Thomas to pay next year too. And obviously Jay Crowder is on one of, if not the best contracts in the NBA for the next couple of years. So them kind of thinking about the future finances also played a role probably in them trading Bradley. And they get Marcus Morris, who is still a competent player, by no means is anywhere close to the defender that Bradley is, but he can certainly help out. And they've got so many forwards. I mean, they have so many wings now, if you think about it. You've got Hayward, Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Morris. I mean, there are so many wings that can just interchange from small forward and power forward. You know, they even added Aaron Baines, which I think is a nice signing for rebounding off the bench. So, you know, as you said, when you can sign a all-star free agent like Gordon Hayward, probably the best available unrestricted free agent this summer, you got to do it no matter what, especially if you can trade Bradley and you still get something back in return for him. So, you know, I don't...
One little wrinkle that sort of gets overlooked is that Marcus Morris is an efficient defender when it comes to guarding LeBron, something that the Celtics are going to be centered on. And I think that's something that people have sort of overlooked in all this, is that Marcus Morris does a pretty decent job guarding LeBron, which gives the Celtics 3 or 4 guys that they can throw at him in a 7-game series.
Yeah, just like in the Western Conference, I think in the Eastern Conference, at least the top 2 to 3 teams, like the Celtics and the Wizards and Raptors, make moves thinking about the Cavs. Just like in the West, all those top, you know, 3 or 4 teams besides the Warriors just make moves based on how they're going to match up with Golden State. And rightly so, because those are the two best teams in the NBA. They made the past 3 finals and probably will make the next, you know, another final or two. But let's go back to the Western Conference, because another Western Conference team added a significant piece as the Nuggets signed Paul Millsap. And I cannot love this signing anymore. Like, I think this is one of the best free agency signings based on fit. I think Millsap is probably the perfect fit alongside both the young guards that the Nuggets have that can shoot and Nikola Jokic, who is one of the most fascinating players to watch, one of the most enjoyable players to watch, in my opinion. Millsap is so incredible defensively. He's incredibly versatile. He's a good veteran presence in the locker room for, you know, very young team. And the Nuggets, I think they missed the playoffs by like half a game, or maybe based on the tiebreaker last year. I would expect them to make the jump to the playoffs next year along with the Timberwolves. So that could, you know, make things interesting in the playoff race for teams that got worse this summer, which we'll talk about a little bit later in this episode. But what are your thoughts on this Paul Millsap signing for the Nuggets?
Yeah, I'm probably not quite as high on it as you are. I love it, you know, from a basketball point of view. Paul Millsap's a guy who can stretch the floor, although not as efficiently in the past few years as he was a couple of years ago, particularly when he was in Utah.
Yeah.
I do love him from a basketball point of view, and I love him from a sort of tempering young steel. Like, he's a veteran. He's going to come in. He's going to help these young guys grow, particularly guys like Gary Harris and Jokic. Those are the guys that I think he's going to have the biggest impact on. And I feel like maybe the biggest impact of Paul Millsap is going to be felt a couple of years out as this ripple starts to settle out, when you see these young guys start to grow. I'm maybe not as high on it for the reason that the Western Conference is loaded, and they went 40-42 last year. Ostensibly, you believe that Paul Millsap probably adds 4 wins to that, which puts them in the 44 win range. But the Western Conference is going to be so, so good that 44 wins is flirting with the edge of the 7-8 seed, maybe not even making the playoffs. So it's going to be very hard for me for the Nuggets to move the needle. And while I love it, and while I 100% would do the deal, that's probably the biggest holdback for me on this.
Yeah, and, you know, I think it is somewhat notable to point out that they did lose Gallinari, but they were fine with that as well. But I think in terms of looking at the Nuggets, in terms of where they could stand in the playoff race next year, it's important to kind of note that they got better. I mean, they got significantly better. I'd say I think that losing Gallinari in exchange of getting Paul Millsap is a significant upgrade. I know they play somewhat different positions, but you have to kind of look at, like, the other Western Conference teams, like the Blazers and the Grizzlies, who kind of, I think, got, you know, the Grizzlies, you could argue, stay the same, but I think that they ultimately got worse, and the Blazers didn't make any moves. So the Blazers barely beat the Nuggets last year. I think the Nuggets got better, so there could be some just like jumping them in terms of fitting in the playoffs. But also, if you kind of think about what kind of progressions will guys like Gary Harris and Jokic make? I mean, Jokic didn't even start, you know, the majority of all those games last year. I think the first 2 months they were, you know, Mike Malone was stuck between deciding between Nurkic and Jokic, and that was pretty ugly. And then they finally decided on Jokic, and then he kind of exploded. If they can start off the season with that, their perfect starting five with Millsap there, they can get off to a better start than last season. So I think that, you know, obviously it's too early. It's only July 21st, but it's very interesting to see which teams will fall out of the playoff race to fit in teams like the Nuggets and the Timberwolves.
Yeah, I mean, I think you probably hit that on the head, that Portland and Minnesota are the guys that you would immediately tag for being worse. My problem with Denver right now is they don't have a point guard. They're still working with Moutier. That, you know, Jamal Murray's not quite where they want him to be, and that he's probably not a full-time point guard. I think they have a lot of work to do between now and the regular season, maybe even add another player. But I do think you're probably right. Like, now that I think about it and hear you say it, yeah, there are probably 2 or 3 teams that got worse, and that'll give the Nuggets a chance to get in, because they went 40-42, and I think Portland went 41-41. So it's not – you're talking about a half step to get into the playoffs, and Paul Millsap is definitely worth more than a half step.
Yeah, that's why I think that the Nuggets will – you know, I would comfortably pick the Nuggets to make the playoffs, but again, really, really early to do that. You know, we talked about the big trades, we talked about the big signings, but there are also a lot of smaller free agency signings that I really liked and, you know, could actually end up making the difference. You know, it would be, you know, these small role players could decide a couple of regular season games, which, especially in the Western Conference, could do a whole lot in terms of changing the standings. I mean, I could see it next year where the 2 seed and the 5th seed are like 1 game apart, with everyone else being decided by tiebreakers. That's how close some of these teams are. So I want to start off with the Rockets, because I think that their depth signings were, one, really important, but two, really significant in terms of building a team that could challenge in the West, and specifically challenge the Warriors. So as we mentioned in the CP3 deal, the Rockets lost a lot of depth, but they ended up signing PJ Tucker, Luke Mbamute, Tariq Black as the 3rd center. They re-signed Nene. Obviously, they still got Eric Gordon off the bench. That is a really good bench, but more importantly, they actually have a lot of good defenders now. Last year, the Rockets were 18th defensively, which is better than most people expected, but now I could totally see the Rockets jumping up to like top 12 defensively, because they added CP3, a great defender. Tucker's a very good defender. Bamute's a good defender. They still got Trevor Ariza there. Clint Capella's still there. Nene can be a good situational defender. And perhaps more importantly, you've got now, I'd say you got 3 defenders on the wings that you can throw out a team like Golden State. You've got Ariza, you've got Tucker, and you've got Bamute, and then you have CP3 in the backcourt. you know, that's a team that could, that's a very good defensive team that also shouldn't sacrifice that much offensively. Obviously, you know, it's going to be tough to play Ariza Tucker and Bamute on the court at the same time because, you know, those three aren't, you know, very good shooters. But when you have a great point guard like Chris Paul or James Harden on the floor, which they might have at all times if they stagger minutes, you know, those point guards can create open shots for those, you know, good to mediocre shooters. So I think I just love how the Rockets, you know, built back that depth but got better defensive pieces than last season.
Yeah, I mean, that's the genius of Daryl Morey. He's turning these guys that he traded off his bench into better guys. Like PJ Tucker's fantastic defensively. Luka Mbamute, I watched the Clippers a good bit last year, and I feel like he's probably not quite as impressive on the court as he is on paper. He did not have a great season, and he looked sort of just out of fit, even with Chris Paul. So I'll be interested to see how they sort of work him into the rotation. I love Tucker, though. That's a fantastic sign. And bringing back Nene on a pretty reasonable deal is pretty good, too. I think that they're probably about – in the playoffs, they're probably about – 8 or 9 deep, which is about where you want to be because you don't want to play too many players in the playoffs, but I definitely think that they probably have one more move, and you know, maybe that move is for Carmelo Anthony, which would sort of change things again for them. But as the team, as it's situated right now, if they don't add Carmelo Anthony, they're probably one buyout player short of what they'll be going into the playoffs, I think.
Yeah, and the important thing for the Rockets is they have to start resting in the regular season. They admitted it when they lost to the Spurs in the second round. They basically said, D'Antoni and I think Morey and maybe Harden as well, basically said that, you know, we're gonna rest more next season. And obviously they got Chris Paul, who's, I think, what, 31 or 32? So he should rest. I mean, if you want to have your best Chris Paul for the playoffs, you need to rest him during the regular season. And, you know, they still could use another, you know, ball-handling guard, which I think they might be able to get for the veterans minimum later this offseason. But having these wings, you know, having Tucker and Bamute can limit the minutes of an Ariza to get more rest for him. And obviously none of these guys, especially Tucker and Bamute, should be playing extremely heavy minutes, so they should also be rested for the playoffs. But they need to be deep for the regular season in order to have their best 8 or 9 for the playoffs, which is always important for teams that are trying to make long playoff runs like the Rockets. Let's move to another smaller signing. Again, we're going back to Oklahoma City because I really like their signing of Patrick Patterson. Patterson is an underrated – I think he's very underrated. He's developed into a good floor spacing big. He's good defensively. There was that insane stat. I don't remember what it was, but basically when he signed, someone had tweeted how good the Raptor – how good his plus-minus was with the Raptors. I think with him on the court, they outscored teams by 100, and with him off the court, they were, like, outscored by, like – something crazy. And, you know, Patterson will probably start at power forward, and he can provide spacing on the floor, especially if they have Andre Roberson starting, who they also re-signed for 3 years, $30 million. So I'm just a huge fan of the Patrick Patterson signing for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I really am, too. Toronto is one of those teams where they get kind of ball stuck because of DeRozan and Lowry, and he still managed to shoot 37% from three. He was a really efficient player. He was a really high quality defensive player, and I think that is just getting a pickup like that. You want guys who can do two things. They can shoot three pointers and play defense, and that's exactly what Patrick Patterson does. That's what you look for in a bench guy. So I love the pickup for them. They still have a lot of problems they got to work through. I feel like strictly because you can't play Enes Kanter and Steven Adams together, and now adding Patrick Patterson to that sort of alleviates because he can play with either one of those guys. But I feel like at some point you have to make a decision of which guy you want just so you can move on and start to create a more efficient, more smoothed out lineup.
You're talking about deciding between Kanter and Adams?
Yeah. And like bringing in Patrick Patterson definitely helps, you know, because he is a guy who can stretch the floor. He's a guy who can do a little bit of everything. But, you know, they can't play together. And so that's a weird thing for me for Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I can kind of see what your point. I also kind of see the opposite. I mean, if Patterson does start at power forward, which I think he should, and I think many others would agree with that, you know, having Kanter as that guy when teams go to their bench, you bring in a guy like Enes Kanter, and maybe the Thunder stagger minutes, so if Westbrook's off the floor, George is there as well. So maybe a George on the floor with Kanter as well would help. But having a guy like Kanter who's really good offensively in the post, having a guy just to throw down there for those, you know, against the other opposing bench bigs, I think is really huge. I think Kanter would start for a lot of other teams. Obviously, they would be pretty bad defensively if he was a starting center, but offensively, he's one of the best centers or big men, I guess you could say, in the league. So I think that having him to throw the ball to in the post for bench possessions when he comes off the bench as a sixth man is really huge for a Thunder team that could use that offensive spurt when they go to their bench.
Sorry to cut you off here, but the way the Western Conference is, I mean, he played 9 minutes a game last year in the playoffs. Like, he's a guy who gets lost defensively. He doesn't bring a ton to the table. He only scored 4 points a game during the playoffs last year. He feels like one of those guys that just sort of gets lost in the swirl of the Western Conference, particularly when it comes to these small lineups where you play a lot of forwards, you play a lot of twos and threes. I just don't love Enes Kanter. And so, I mean, I disagree with you. I totally acknowledge your point, but I just don't see him as a guy I want to build around, and that's just my personal opinion.
Oh yeah, and it might be at this point already where he really can't play in the playoffs. I mean, he can be a fine regular season backup big to take advantage of opposing big men on the bench and get some points in the post, but as we saw against the Rockets, I mean, there was that funny clip when Harden had embarrassed him in the pick and roll, and Billy Donovan turns to Mo Cheeks and just says, can't play Kanter, because he couldn't play. You can't play Kanter against teams that go small and use the pick and roll a lot, like a team like the Rockets do with James Harden. So maybe we're already at the point where Kanter can't play in the playoffs. But, you know, I think that for the regular season, I think, in terms of having a backup big that can get you some points in the post, you know, that can be pretty important for the regular season. But, again, he might be done for playoff time. But, all right, we're going back again to the Timberwolves. We had mentioned that they made other signings. Their two other significant signings were Jeff Teague and Taj Gibson. I'm not a huge fan of the Teague signing. They traded away Rubio, and they signed Teague, who's, I think, 3 years older, and he's getting more money. I think it was 3 years, 57 was the contract or something like that. But I guess he does provide more shooting than Rubio, even though he's not like a knockdown shooter, so I wouldn't go crazy about his shooting that he adds to the Timberwolves. So I'm not a huge fan of that Teague signing. I'm a pretty good big fan, I guess, of the Gibson signing, mainly because it'll help out defensively and on the boards, and he's a pretty good veteran leader and teammate. And obviously, he and Butler are both experienced playing under Tom Thibodeau, which is a big adjustment period, as we saw last year, for those young guys. So having two guys who have played with Thibodeau who can still contribute, especially defensively, will be big. But as we talked about before, I think especially Gibson, if he starts at power forward, that can really cramp the Timberwolves' spacing. And they don't really have much spacing to begin with this lineup and starting lineup of a Teague, Wiggins, Butler, maybe Gibson and Towns. So what are your thoughts on these two signings as it pertains to the Wolves?
Yeah, you're kind of in my head on this one, because Jeff Teague just does not do anything for me. For me personally, I would have rather had Rubio, because Rubio is so transcendent. Even in lineups where you don't have great spacing, his passing ability opens up lanes, and that's not who Jeff Teague is. Jeff Teague is a guy who sort of is ball dominant. He can spread the ball around, but he only averaged – he averaged 7 assists last year, so I'll give him that. But, like, normally he's in, like, the 5-6 range, which is not great for a guy you want playing the 1. I don't love this signing. I don't think it adds a ton of spacing. I don't think it does a ton for Minnesota. And I probably would have rather had Ricky Rubio, but Tibbs is a lot smarter than I am, so obviously he knows something I don't. But when it comes to Gibson, yeah, I'm with you. Gibson brings a lot of things. He brings veteran leadership for your young forwards. He brings defensive presence, and he just brings that gutsiness that you're going to need to win games in the loaded Western Conference.
Yeah, I think that adding a guy like Gibson and Butler are just two pieces that help out defensively. Another year for those young guys under Thibodeau should help defensively and with their growth as well. So this Timberwolves team, while it probably has very little spacing, little to no spacing at all, will be one of those teams you just don't want to play. You know, they'll beat you up, they'll be physical, they'll be tough defensively, and that's how they'll win a lot of their games, I think. But I'm in agreement with you. I'm not a huge fan of the Teague signing, but I do like the Taj Gibson signing. The final team I want to talk about is the Kings, because I think they had a really interesting offseason. Some people hate their offseason, some people like it. I've kind of went back and forth. I think I'm ultimately on the side that I do like their offseason. They signed George Hill to a 3-year deal, they signed Zach Randolph to a 2-year deal, and they signed Vince Carter to a 1-year deal. So they did take two of those Grizzlies in Randolph and Carter. But the thing with the Kings is, you know, they're pretty open about building a good culture, and I think that adding Hill, Randolph, and Carter, who are two or three of the most respected teammates and veterans in this league is a great way to do that, especially for a guy like Hill to influence De'Aaron Fox, their, you know, their future franchise cornerstone, they hope. I guess my question with the Kings is for you is if you like their offseason, and my question personally is, I wonder how many minutes that these guys, these veterans, are going to get, because George Hill, when healthy, is still a really good point guard in this league. Zach Randolph can still help out a little bit. We saw Vince Carter, even as he's 40 years old, is still a decent role player off the bench. So it'll be interesting to see how many minutes these guys get, because they did get, you know, Hill got a pretty expensive contract.
Yeah, I'm sort of in the camp that I love the Kings offseason. They needed to change their culture 180 degrees. I mean, coming out of the DeMarcus Cousins saga, obviously DeMarcus Cousins sort of held them for ransom as an organization. They've moved away from that. And a lot of people sort of killed them on that trade. But now looking back, it looks pretty decent compared to what you can get for other superstars in this league, sort of against the Paul George and Jimmy Butler. It feels like a pretty good trade. I think Landon De'Aaron Fox is a fantastic pickup for them. I love Fox. He's got a killer instinct. He's personable. He's charming. He's everything you want in a franchise player, and you just hope that he sort of plays up to that. When it comes to the signings, though, this is where I think one of the most brilliant things is you added a guy like Vince Carter. You added Zach Randolph. You added George Hill, all of whom are these high-character veterans who are going to help you learn. But more importantly, they're also guys who aren't going to win games for you. And I think the Kings are sort of in a quiet tank. They're not going to advertise it the way the process was advertised. But if they can, you know, get two or three more lottery picks over the next couple of years, and I know they owe one of their picks out in 2019, but if they can get a couple more quality high quality lottery picks out there, there will definitely be the building of a good team going on, because you already have Buddy Hield, you have Willie Cauley-Stein, you have De'Aaron Fox, Justin Jackson, and Harry Giles. Like that's pretty good floor for them.
Yeah, they have a really crazy young core that has a lot of potential. Some of them have already shown that potential. And then I think they added the perfect veterans. I mean, they basically added a veteran at almost every position, you know, guard, wing, and big, to influence the young guys they got at every position, guard, wing, and big. So I think that I'm agreeing with you. I do ultimately like the Kings offseason. It's a very interesting way to kind of go about what they should be tanking to make sure that their 2018 pick is really good. But it's an interesting way to go about it, you know, spending money on these veterans to get them to bring in a good culture, good attitude, and influence these young guys as they are bad next year. But ultimately, this offseason could pay off huge down the road for the Kings in the next 2 to 3 years when their young guys are ready to take over as the franchise leader. So a very one of the more interesting offseasons, I think, from the Kings. All right, let's finish our discussion of the offseason and free agency with a little bit of a winners and losers. So, you know, I've got a list in front of me of winners and losers. We've already talked about some of them, like the Rockets, Thunder, and Timberwolves. Ultimately, I see all those teams as winners, including the Nuggets as well. But there's some other teams that I think are winners that we haven't talked about yet, and that one of them is the Golden State Warriors. Somehow, they had one of the better offseasons in the league. They were able to get KD to take less, which we can talk about, which allowed them to bring back their core, Andre Iguodala, Sean Livingston. But then they were also able to add Omri Caspi and Nick Young. Now, Nick Young is kind of redundant. They don't really need Young, but I think Caspi is a very good signing, especially for the minimum. Kind of a floor spacing power forward who can shoot. He's a decent defender. So the fact that they're able to add both of those, and they also brought back Pachulia, I mean, the Warriors got better, and they dominated the league in the playoffs last year. It's just incredible.
Favorite guy that they added is Jordan Bell. Jordan Bell is my favorite addition. I've been high on Jordan Bell. I'm getting that out there. I want everybody to know that I'm high on Jordan Bell. But adding all these guys at this price is so fantastic. They're a team that just retools. Like, obviously, you've got your Steph Currys, Klay Thompson, Kevin Durant, Andre Iguodala, and then you just put guys around them. And Caspi and Nick Young, they're just guys who can come in and create and get buckets. And it just makes it so hard for teams to keep pace with them, with the Warriors, when their starters are off the floor. And so I love this. The understated part of this is Kevin Durant taking less money, because a lot of people said, you know, great teammate, which is true. All these things are true. He is a great teammate, and he's thinking team first. But to me, this sort of reeks of Kevin Durant remembering the James Harden trade. If you remember, Oklahoma City was up against a luxury tax. They had to do something, and obviously they had that young core of Kevin Durant, Russell Westbrook, and James Harden, and they moved on from Harden. And I feel like Kevin Durant taking more money here is just that sort of standing out in his memory as a watershed moment in his career. So if he can take less money, he can keep Klay Thompson in the fold. He can help, you know, Steph get paid and all these things that he can play on a better team. And I feel like that's what sort of happened in Oklahoma City, was that they were pushed up against it. And now if he takes a little bit off, it allows them the flexibility to do some of the things that they've done to maintain their dominance in the Western Conference.
Yeah, it's such a huge part of their offseason was KD taking less money, allowing them to bring back their core and add these two pieces in Caspi and Nick Young, and obviously Jordan Bell, who they just paid the Bulls the draft, which, again, we talked about the Bulls had, you know, something a very incompetent offseason. But it's just the rich getting richer, and that's the thing. When you're a team that, especially, we haven't really seen this. This is a team that's almost guaranteed to make the finals and very close to being guaranteed to winning the championship after what we saw them do to the Cavs last year. And players will take minimums if they want to become champions. I mean, this is Nick Young will be the second former Wizard that the Warriors will probably turn into a champion after they did it to JaVale McGee last year. So we got to get Gilbert Arenas back in the league to do that now. So the Warriors are, I think, are a big winner. And you know, we saw all these teams, the Rockets and the Thunder, Timberwolves and Nuggets, all added significant pieces. But then the Warriors added these smaller, minor pieces that will just continue their dominance over the West and over the league over the next couple of years. Now, let's go back to the Eastern Conference for another winner that I have. I have the 76ers as a winner. Obviously, they made that blockbuster trade to move up to get Markelle Fultz, and I think is a very good fit alongside Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid for that young trio, I guess. But they also got J.J. Redick and Amir Johnson on good one-year deals. I think Redick is a perfect shooting guard who adds so much floor spacing. We actually posted our 76ers team offseason review on the 94 Feet Report today, and a really great breakdown from one of our writers on how much floor spacing and contributions that Redick can provide. And then Amir Johnson is just a good veteran big who can rebound, help out somewhat defensively, a good presence there. Again, both being on one-year deals is huge because it still keeps their cap space open for 2018 when the 76ers will probably be truly ready to compete. But they can still contribute this year. And obviously, you know, building that young core, adding folds to kind of complete the process, I guess you call it, is another great move for the Sixers. So I have them as winners this summer.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you can move up to take consensus number one, you do that. And they did that. They got their guy. And it feels like Ball, Tatum, Jackson were sort of weird fits for them. So giving up something to get into number one to take a guy that was their best fit player is a really good move. I really like the 76ers and what they've done. I like Ad Reddick. I like Amir Johnson. But also, I'm not ready for the coronation just yet. I sort of stand by skeptically. People saying, yeah, they've got this great young core, but also they need Joel Embiid to be on the floor more than 31 games in a season, and there's just no evidence that can happen. And I'm not saying it won't happen. I'm just saying that if you're looking at past performance, which doesn't guarantee future returns, but if you're looking at past performance, there's no guarantee that Joel Embiid's going to be on the floor. And he becomes such a pivotal piece to the success of this team that a team with Markelle Fultz, Ben Simmons, and J.J. Redick is a pretty good team, but a team with those three guys plus Joel Embiid is a really good team. And I feel like that there's such a difference for them in terms of what they can do with Embiid on the floor versus without him on the floor, that I feel like that I'm not quite ready to have the coronation ceremony for the process just yet until I can see that Joel Embiid can play a healthy season.
Yeah, and that's the most important factor, I think, for the Sixers. Last year when Embiid was playing in those 31 games, they had, I think they had like the number one ranked defense in the minutes he played. And then when he wasn't playing, they had like the 28th ranked defense, so such a huge drop-off. But if you, yeah, like you said, I'm not really ready to coronate them. I'm definitely not ready to pick them for the playoffs. But if you can tell me, if you told me that Joel Embiid will play 65 games, I would feel fairly, and Ben Simmons would also play, because he has an injury history now, and big men with foot injuries is not something you ever want. But if you would tell me that both of those guys would play at least 65 games and the rest of their core would play, you know, normal like 75 to 80 games, I would maybe pick them for an AC just because of how weak the Eastern Conference is. I mean, we know the Pacers and the Bulls, well, definitely the Bulls are out of the playoffs. Pacers could also drop out too. Teams above the Sixers didn't get that much better. I mean, the Knicks did not really get better. The Magic didn't get better if they finished, I think, the same record or something like that. But I would be somewhat comfortable in picking the Sixers to make the playoffs if you could somehow guarantee me that both Embiid and Simmons would play at least 65 games. But again, as you said, there really is no indication that that can happen yet, so we have to wait and see. But I think that's why these one-year deals are so important, because they're going to open up money for 2018, which is when their core will be another year older, another year playing together, probably a nice good culture with Redick and Amir Johnson as veteran presence. So that's when I think they're ready to really strike for, you know, a top six, top five playoff seed in 2018.
Yeah, this is the classic scenario of you're building, you want playoff experience for the guys. That's why they signed Redick. That's why they signed Amir Johnson. They want a seven seed or an eight seed, because you start to temper guys like Fultz, like Simmons, like Embiid. You want them to have that playoff experience.
Yeah, that's a huge thing. So before we get into to losers, do you have any other winners on your list?
I mean, yeah, nothing really transcendent. I feel like the Celtics are big winners, adding Gordon Hayward. I really feel like the Hawks are kind of winners, and I know that's going to be weird to say, but the Hawks passing on Paul Millsap, I think, is really smart, and I know a lot of people lampooned him for that decision, but they passed on offering Paul Millsap, and it let them sort of switch gears into this rebuilding mode, and I feel like they're going to be a team that is going to bottom out through the year. Plus, they picked up a guy that I really like in John Collins. So I feel like they're winners in that they got their game plan moving. They weren't indecisive about it. So I really put them in my winners column as well.
I can see that. And I forgot to mention the Hawks is a team that will probably drop out. So that's another open playoff spot in the East, in the wide open Eastern Conference that saw 3 to 4 stars move to the West, which is just insane. But let's turn our attention.
A team will get in with 38 wins. Like that, I'm saying that right now. A team will get in the playoffs with 38.
Yeah, I'm very comfortable in saying that. And meanwhile, a team with 50 wins in the West could miss the playoffs. So that's how crazy it could be. But let's turn our attention to some losers. I've got a couple. I'm going to start with the Knicks. I'm actually a big Tim Hardaway Jr. fan, but I'm not a big enough fan to even get close to liking that deal. I like the Knicks.
$72 million Tim Hardaway Jr. fan?
Yeah, no. The rumor was the Hawks would be willing to do 4 years, 48, and I think that other teams were thinking that's a reasonable deal. And then all of a sudden, the Knicks come here with 4 years. I think it was 71 or 72. Okay, yeah. I think it's 71, but they come with 71 over 4 years, over 22 or 23 million more than the Hawks and most other teams were willing to do. We had reports that other front offices were laughing at this contract, and the thing is that I almost feel bad for Hardaway Jr. I mean, I don't feel bad for him because he's making so much money, but just like he's always going to be looked down upon now because he's never going to live up to that contract. He's a fine player. He had a breakout year last year. I think he averaged like 14.5 points per game. He's an explosive scorer who can sometimes just take over games offensively. He has to improve defensively. He's 24. I like the Knicks signing him. If it was like for the 4 years, 48, I would love the signing, but because it's 4 years, 71, and you add it to the other bad contracts they have, like Joakim Noah, it's just another dumbfounding signing from the Knicks. They gave Ron Baker, I think, almost $9 million over 2 years for someone who, you know, isn't not good. And then they got this Carmelo Anthony fiasco, which is partly due to blame of Phil Jackson, and he's gone, but he did publicly bash Carmelo, and the ownership and everyone else kind of didn't say anything about it. And now it's going to force them to trade Melo, which they're probably fine with in the end, but just this fiasco, just this drama and this unneeded attention from the Knicks puts them as a loser for me.
Oh yeah, 100% agree. It's just a comedy of errors. Everything the Knicks do, they have the opposite of the Midas touch. I mean, this Tim Hardaway deal, I saw this crazy thing on Twitter that Tim Hardaway is going to make more money in this deal than his dad did in his entire NBA career, and his dad was like an all-star caliber player.
Yeah.
So I thought that was funny. But they've alienated Porzingis. They've alienated Carmelo Anthony. They've overpaid Tim Hardaway. Everything they've done has just been awful this season, and they're probably a team that needs to do a full rebuild around Porzingis, and they just don't look like they're committed to doing that. So it's just bizarre. Everything the Knicks does, it is just bizarre to me.
Yeah, at least we can thank the Knicks for providing endless drama and storylines for the NBA fans. But another losing offseason for the Knicks. My other losing team is in the same division. I got the Raptors as a loser. I think because they did add CJ Miles and they were able to bring back Kyle Lowry and Serge Ibaka, and especially Lowry, they didn't have to give him a full max. They gave him 3 years instead of, I think it would be five was his potential max. And they got Ibaka for, I think, 3 years, 65. It's fine to bring those players back, but they did lose Tucker and Patterson. I think that those are two big depth pieces and also two big defensive pieces for the Raptors. And they added CJ Miles, but he's not a very good defender. He's a good shooter, which they do need some floor spacing, but I think they lost some depth and some defense in Tucker and Patterson, and they got some young guys that are ready to contribute, but obviously haven't been tested for a full regular season against heavy, you know, heavy minutes. So I think the Raptors are slight losers in an Eastern Conference where the Celtics got better, and the Cavs are still the Cavs.
Yeah, I don't love – I mean, the Raptors got swept out of the playoffs last year, and they didn't really change anything. Maybe they're okay with being a 50-win team because that's probably what they're going to be. But there's nothing that's exciting about this Raptors roster. Like, obviously, we know what Lowry and DeRozan bring to the table, and it's not quite enough to compete with Cleveland, and it's not quite enough even probably to compete with Boston now. And I don't love – anything that the Raptors are doing. I feel like at some point, and maybe they're gonna, maybe this is a controlled rebuild, maybe they're gonna look to move guys at the deadline if it starts to not work out or it doesn't work the way they want to. So maybe they just wanted to control their own destiny with guys like Kyle Lowry. But I'll be interested to see, because there's no way to sell this as we're competitive in the Eastern Conference against the Cleveland Cavaliers to your fan base. So I'll be interested to see what it is that they're trying to achieve with this core.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to see what happens, especially, you know, Lowry can have some injury issues and that team, you know, could struggle and be kind of not a 50-win team, maybe mid-40s, and that would, you know, put them potentially in the middle of the Eastern Conference playoffs and maybe get them eliminated early in the playoffs. They haven't had much playoff success, especially from guys like Lowry and DeRozan, so it's interesting to see the Raptors basically bringing back the core or the same crew, except losing a little bit of depth and losing some defensive pieces. Another team I think I have a slight losers again are the Wizards, because I think they ultimately, you know, it's basically the same team, but they did ultimately, I think, get slightly worse. They lost Bogdanovich. They did add a guy like Jody Meeks, but, you know, I don't think Meeks is as good as Bogdanovich is at this point. And now, you know, the Porter contract really puts them stuck, because they're going to be really cramped financially due to this Porter contract. But then again, they really couldn't just let him go for nothing. And that's the problem that they were facing with Porter. Now he gets 4 years, $106 million, which is absolutely insane. But obviously, restricted free agents or other teams set the market, and the Nets were the ones who did that to the Wizards. So I think the Wizards got slightly worse now and also in the long term in terms of financials.
Yeah, the big loser, the big thing that makes them a loser for me is that John Wall hasn't signed his designated player contract. Like, he hasn't signed that extension. And that sort of is alarming to me. And maybe he's going to do it the next couple days. There have been rumblings that maybe he's going to do it. Ted Leonosis seems to think that he's going to do it. But that's what's troublesome to me, is like, you have this core. You have Bradley Beal. You have Otto Porter. You got Markieff Morris. You got Gortat. Like, that's the team that they had last year. Their bench was really thin, and that ended up costing them some games against the Celtics in a series that went seven. But I don't see a lot of improvement, and the scary part of that is that John Wall may take his talents elsewhere, because the Wizards have no flexibility and they can't add key pieces to improve.
Yeah, I would be really worried, especially if Wall doesn't assign this extension. I would be very, very worried if I'm a Wizards fan and if I'm in the Wizards front office as well. And another loser I have are the Portland Trailblazers. I mentioned them before when we were talking about the Nuggets, you know, jumping up into the playoff spot. You know, I mentioned that the Blazers really had no money to make any moves. They were just financially strapped. They didn't make any moves. Now, they're trying to get into a Carmelo Anthony sweepstakes, but, you know, all reports are is that he wouldn't waive his no-trade clause to join them. And even if he did join them, you know, that wouldn't push them up that much like it would for a team maybe like the Rockets. But the fact that the Blazers, who in an offseason were so many teams, especially the Nuggets and Wolves, who were below them last year, got better, and teams above them got significantly better, the fact that they couldn't make any moves, I have them as a loser in the bloodbath that will be the Western Conference next year.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. They had so much money going into last free agency, and they spent all that money on guys who are either number five starters or number six on the bench. Like, they just didn't improve all that much, and they spent a ton of money and they locked up their cap, and the Blazers are just stuck, and I feel like that's a pretty terrible place to be. I mean, granted they add Nurkic, and I think that once they get a full season with him, they're going to be fun to watch. But yeah, with the rest of the Western Conference moving so far forward, it feels like them staying in place is a big loss for them.
Exactly. Just staying in place. I mean, and maybe in other offseasons, staying in place is fine, but not this offseason when the Western Conference got this much better. Both teams ahead of them and below them got better. Do you have any other losers on your list?
I mean, obviously, you got to say Chicago's a loser. They just have not been apt as a front office, because the Jimmy Butler trade was awful. I don't think that Lauri Markkanen's a very good player. So Chicago definitely ends up in there. And I also think Utah, but it's not really their fault. I mean, just losing out on the Gordon Hayward sweepstakes is going to be bad for them. Now, they added a really interesting piece in Donovan Mitchell, who I will be very, very interested to watch. But I feel like they probably lost out by losing their all-star.
Yeah, and I think that the Jazz, you know, they added Rubio, who I think could help, and is younger than George Hill. They did be able to sign guys like Cephalosha. They re-signed Joe Ingles. So, you know, this team is going to be worse, but I think it's still due to the coaching. I was blanking on his name somehow. I think the combination of Snyder's coaching and just, you know, how well they are defensively will still put them in the playoffs. That's just, you know, my take. I'm just really big on Quinn Snyder and, you know, how he's developed his team so far. And obviously Rudy Gobert is an incredible defensive piece and one of the best big men in the league, I think. So I put them as a loser. I think I'd put them as a slight loser just because they did, you know, they did end up losing their all-star. And of course it was a very cringe-worthy way on July 4th when he announced it and then took it back then announced it again. But those are just some winners and losers. And you had mentioned Donovan Mitchell. I want to talk briefly about summer league impressions. I have not watched all that much Summer League. I have been watching a lot of the highlight clips on YouTube, which are very convenient. But I want to ask you some guys who impressed you the most. Because guys, as you mentioned, Donovan Mitchell is really impressive. I think Troy Williams on the Rockets was really impressive. Kyle Kuzma on the Lakers. Obviously, Dennis Smith Jr. was really, really impressive. Who were some guys that impressed you the most this Summer League?
I mean, you did a pretty good list. That's a pretty good list of the guys who impressed me. I will throw on top of that Lonzo Ball. I've been a big Lonzo Ball advocate since the draft process for a long time. I think he's a guy who makes his teammates better. Obviously, Kuzma benefited from that in Summer League. Not to take away from what Kuzma did as a player, but he definitely benefited from Lonzo Ball. I'm really pleased with Lonzo Ball, and I hate saying that. Let me make a point in saying I hate saying that because he's a Laker and I'm a huge Celtics fan. I don't want the Lakers to succeed ever, but begrudgingly, I have to say that Lonzo Ball has just been phenomenally impressive to me. And I can't wait to see what, when he's playing at that high level competition, when he sort of has that target on his back that LeVar's put on there with all the talk, I'll be interested to see how he rises to the occasion. But he's definitely been impressive to me. Another guy that I was really impressed with was Jason Tatum, because Tatum didn't show anything that we didn't expect, but the things that we did expect came in such a high degree. He's got fantastic footwork. He's a guy who can create his own shot. And I think he's a guy who's going to fit in well with the Celtics culture. So those are two guys that weren't on your list. Obviously, Mitchell, crazy impressive, phenomenally athletic, just a guy who was going to be a real joy to watch. And then Kuzma's probably going to fight for rotation minutes. I mean, I feel like a lot of guys really did well with their stock, their draft stock, going into the regular season.
Yeah, it was an impressive summer league for a lot of players. Of course, on the other hand, there are obviously always some disappointments. Just me being a Rockets fan, I'll tell you, Chinonu Onuwaku was very, very disappointing for me. He looked like he didn't improve at all, and this is going to be his second year in the league, and he looked like he couldn't defend the rim. He didn't look like he got any bigger. His rotations and mobility defensively was just not impressive at all, and not what you want to expect. You know, they were thinking that, you know, they just signed Tariq Black last week, and he'll be the third center, but I think deep down, you know, probably when the offseason started, I think that the Rockets front office was deep down hoping that Onuwaku could be that third center for when Nene is resting. I think they saw that summer league performances and they either realized that, you know, a guy like Tariq Black's out there for a cheap contract and they might as well do it because he's proven and can and handle the minutes. But I think that deep down they were hoping for more from Onuwaku. So he's been probably the biggest disappointment for me, you know, being a Rockets fan.
My biggest disappointments are Markel Fultz, Malik Monk, Harry Giles, all these guys. I was excited. I love Summer League. I get locked into Summer League every year, and I spend like a week doing nothing but watching basketball. And just to not get to see Fultz beyond just a couple of games, to not get to see – I really wanted to see Brandon Ingram, and to not see Harry Giles or Malik Monk at all, that's my biggest disappointment, because – I really want to see the tools that these guys have because they have such interesting skill sets, particularly when in regards to Malik Monk. And so those are my big disappointments beyond, obviously, and I hate to say that, even say this, but I beat on this guy. Like, Markkanen was just not impressive to me.
Yeah, yeah, and it was really disappointing. I'm really big on the Malik Monk drafting for the Hornets. I think he's perfect for what they need in terms of shooting and creating. It was really disappointing to not see a bunch of those guys there. And you know, Markkanen, really. I mean, I feel bad for Markkanen now because he'll always be kind of, you know, him and Dunn and Levine. I feel bad for Levine now that he's going back Chicago, you know, the team that's going to be really, really bad, and people are going to kind of put him as the face of the return for Jimmy Butler. But yeah, just another bad offseason for the Bulls, another interesting and captivating summer league. And you know, summer league is getting a lot more popular now. We saw that the ratings were up on ESPN. You know, the social media engagement for summer league was really big now. And obviously some of that's due to a really great draft class, which you don't get every year. But just another fascinating summer league and really another incredibly fascinating offseason. So I want to thank you, Alex, for joining us. Before we go, why don't you throw out where everyone can find your work and where they can find you on social media?
You can follow the podcast at N1 Analytics on Twitter. You can follow me personally. My handle is @_Alex_West. And make sure and read, you know, all the things that I'm doing on the 94 Feet Report. I'm getting ready to have a Charlotte Hornets piece on the offseason review. And so you find the podcast at the 94 Feet Report. There's just all kinds of places that you can follow me.
Yeah, so everyone make sure to check out Alex and the podcast, and make sure to follow me on Twitter @EricSpiros, and follow our website on Twitter @The94FeetReport, and make sure to stay tuned for our team offseason review series. We post a new team every day. So thank you guys for listening to this offseason review / free agent summer league impressions, and take care and have a great weekend. Thanks.